because we're trying to communicate that this is an investment in U.S. competitiveness. The theme of the plan is infrastructure, but the point of the plan and the name of the plan is jobs.
Hi, I'm Jim Doyle, President of Business Forward, and you're listening to the Business Forward podcast. Business Forward helps local business leaders fix Washington by bringing Washington to them. Subscribe to our podcast to hear conversations with policy experts, elected officials, and business leaders about important issues like climate action and affordable healthcare.
In this episode, Business Forward, Small Business for America's Future, and other partners hosted a briefing and Q&A on building our infrastructure back better with Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg. Secretary Buttigieg and New Deal leader Mayor Woodfin of Birmingham, Alabama, discussed integrating racial and regional equity into the American Jobs Plan rollout, creating good jobs, and providing opportunities for small businesses to get involved in infrastructure projects. This briefing is the first in our Build Back Better briefing series. The series covers the Biden administration's policy priorities across a range of topics, including those covered by the American Jobs Plan and the recently passed American Rescue Plan. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Hello, everyone. I'm Liz Fairchild, Executive Director of Business Forward Foundation. We are delighted to host Department of Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg and New Deal leader Mayor Randall Woodfin of Birmingham, Alabama today. We host these briefings to give small business leaders like you a seat at the table to share what's most important to you. We'd also like to thank our partners for engaging and inviting their members, including the Georgia Greater Black Chamber of Commerce, Greater Phoenix Chamber, Massachusetts LGBT Chamber of Commerce, National Asian American Chamber of Commerce, San Antonio Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, Small Business for America's Future, Small Business Majority, Tucson Metro Chamber, and the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Secretary, thank you for joining us today. I'll hand it over to you.
Great. Well, thanks so much. Thank you to Business Forward. Thank you to my friend Mayor Woodfin for agreeing to moderate our conversation. And thanks to all of you for attending, for your day-to-day work building the American economy, and for your interest in how we can build our infrastructure back better than it's ever been. Look, I think we have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity on our hands, a combination of so many stars aligning. First of all, in terms of the demonstrated need for infrastructure investment in this country, but also the bipartisan interest, the economic conditions, the congressional and presidential leadership that we have right now, I think sets us up to do something that we've needed to do for a long time. Every few generations, America gets a chance to make a major step forward in terms of the capabilities of our infrastructure. You could argue going all the way back to the Erie Canal that the decision to do that, which was an aggressive and ambitious decision for its time, that really involved expanding the definition of infrastructure as it was known back then. You could argue that building the Erie Canal helped not only to grow the economy of the US, but actually to make the United States into one country in reality, and not just on paper. About a century or a generation later, the Transcontinental Railroad took shape, and under President Lincoln, steps were taken again, asking people to think about what would not in its day have been considered traditional infrastructure, to build a rail network that today, of course, we couldn't imagine the American economy or society without. A century after that, under Eisenhower, the interstate highway system was built. And with it came a whole new way to connect American communities and to make it possible for Americans to travel the country, coming off a time when it took, even after the invention of the car, a couple of weeks to get from one side of the country to the other. We changed all of that on purpose, with bold investments and major action. And now we come to the dawn of the 2020s, with multiple crises overlapping, having to do with climate, equity, and our economic condition and competitiveness as a country. And that's where the American Jobs Plan comes in. My department estimates we have about a $1 trillion backlog in looking after transportation infrastructure in our country, something we cannot ask states and cities to deal with on their own. We also see the advent of new technologies that we have to prepare for. And we see rising competitors that aren't wasting any time to invest in their infrastructure. The US now ranks 13th globally in the quality of our transportation infrastructure. And frankly, for some time, we've been headed in the wrong direction. I don't think it takes a lot of work to convince Americans that our infrastructure needs investment and needs improvement. But that doesn't mean it'll just happen on its own. Right now, under the president's leadership, we are working with Congress and working to communicate with the American people about why it has to be big and why it has to be now, why we have to improve the roads and bridges, the ports and airports and waterways, the rail and transit systems around this country, as well as areas beyond transportation, beyond what I work on every day. The need for broadband at a time when an internet connection is as important as an interstate connection. The need for water infrastructure improvements, and looking beyond traditional so-called hard infrastructure to the care infrastructure and housing infrastructure of our economy and our society. A lot's going to depend on the leadership of the business community. Businesses that have been crying out for improvements for a very long time because, of course, part of the bottom line is the ability to rely on the infrastructure that we have in this country, and we've been coasting for far too long on investments that were made generations before we even got here. We know that if we make these choices now, economic growth will come with it. One independent analysis by Moody's pointed to the creation of millions of additional jobs if we do this now. And I want to point out the majority of those jobs are jobs that don't require a college degree. I'm enthusiastic about what we could do if we use this golden moment to deliver a new and better infrastructure vision for the country. It's what the American Jobs Plan is all about, and it's why I'm so excited to be here with you. So rather than go on for a long time, I'm really looking forward to getting into a discussion, hearing your questions, thoughts, and ideas as we continue to refine this proposal and seek to move it through Congress this spring and into the summer. So with that, I'll turn it back over.
Thank you, Secretary Buttigieg. Now I'd like to introduce our moderator for today's event, Mayor Randall Woodfin of Birmingham, Alabama. Thank you both for being here. I'm so glad we get to have this discussion today. Mayor Woodfin, I'll hand the conversation over to you.
Thank you, Liz. Also, thank you to the business leaders who are on this call. You know, our local business leaders across the nation have high interest in this topic. And then two more thank yous. Thank you to the president, as well as the Vice President, President Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, for their commitment to investing in our infrastructure. And for this call we are on today, Secretary Buttigieg, thank you for your leadership, sir. As a former mayor, I think you know of all people the importance of this. And this is not just necessarily about policy and a bill, but about getting things done for everyday Americans. So thank you for your passion and your commitment. So we'll dive right into the questions, Mr. Secretary. And this first question is a topic on everyone's mind this week, which is around climate and clean energy. And our first question is from Nicole Boothman Shepherd, who is the Vice President of Resilience and Recovery at AECOM in St. Petersburg, Florida. And Mr. Secretary, her question is, how will infrastructure resources require resilience and climate adaptation planning and design in order to build safe and durable infrastructure for generations?
Thanks, Mayor. It's such a great question. And it is a timely question, whether you're in St. Pete or whether you're in a place like Indiana, where I come from. Every part of this country is seeing the changes that are happening as a consequence of our shifting climate and recognizing, sometimes learning the hard way, that what might have seemed like the right answer 50 years ago isn't going to be the right answer 50 years from now. And since we're making decisions that are going to last for decades, we've got to get it right. It's why we talk about fixing, first of all, the infrastructure we have, fix it first, but also fix it right. If a road's being washed out on an annual basis, putting it right back on an annual basis might not be the right answer. Maybe it needs to be strengthened, changed, or reinvented. Maybe a new route needs to be contemplated. And that's just one example of the steps that we need to take to invest in resilience. The president's vision contains $50 billion for resilience. And that's not only making sure that's integrated in the day-to-day work that we do, but also supporting communities, because you're gonna have a much more detailed understanding of what the resilience needs are community by community than we're gonna be able to prescribe from here in Washington. It means making sure that we recognize the shifts that are happening in modes of transportation. It means taking account of climate effects, especially the increased frequency and severity of major severe weather events. It means making sure that we're doing our part to integrate what's called green infrastructure, sometimes actually the most economically efficient way to deal, for example, with water. I was talking with my counterpart in the Netherlands about this earlier today, is not to build a fortress to keep it out, but to accommodate it as it flows in a way that doesn't damage property or endanger lives. There are so many things we need to do as we look to the future that are going to be different from the past, and that's okay. In fact, it's more than okay because we can create a lot of jobs as we go. And if we get it right, also mitigate climate change from getting any worse than it already will, an imperative that I know we'll be discussing in the next couple of days as the president convenes the Global Climate Summit at the White House.
Thanks for that genuine answer, Mr. Secretary. So the next few questions are on workforce and skills. What I want to do in order to include as many of our small business leaders as possible, Mr. Secretary, is batch a couple questions together. And so the first one is from Tony Stewart, who's the executive director of Michigan Regional Council of Carpenters. And the question is, will there be good paying union jobs and opportunities for locals to be trained to develop a skill set? And the second question is from Jocko Burden, CEO of Maven Construction, Inc. in Boston, Massachusetts, which is, will any portion of the infrastructure work in tandem with the Department of Labor to increase women and people of color in organized labor halls?
What a great set of questions. The short answer is yes. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It's a once-in-a-lifetime investment that makes it a once-in-a-lifetime moment to get this right. Now, as I mentioned, the majority of the jobs we're going to create might not require a college degree, but they are going to require a lot of skills. And the Carpenters is one example of where there is phenomenal work going on. I've seen for myself this facility in Las Vegas that is training carpenters and people in building trades for the different kinds of skills that are going to be needed in the future. Hard technical skills and things like management skills. You know, sometimes the edge of a union contractor has competitively has as much to do with how they handle themselves on a job site and work with other people as the specific technical expertise they have. It's one of the reasons why I know a lot of people are saying, well, not every dollar in this is going directly into a road and a bridge. And that's true. A lot of it's going into things like workforce development and research. And that's something that we've been working closely with my counterpart, Secretary Walsh, who is both a former mayor and a former union leader at the Department of Labor, making sure that we are positioning ourselves to build those kinds of skills that are going to be needed in the future. You know, I think maybe we've made the mistake of making it sound in the past like some of the new jobs being created through climate action are so futuristic that you can't picture them. A lot of them, we're talking about union skilled trades jobs you can think about and picture right now. We're talking about carpenters. We're talking about insulators and glaziers and painters. We're definitely going to need electrical workers for what we're trying to do for the electric vehicle fleet, as well as in manufacturing and so many other areas. After all, the first word in Build Back Better is build. We got to actually do the building, and that requires skilled labor. Now, to the other point, and this is incredibly important, since organized labor and the quality union jobs that exist in America and that we're hoping to create more of, since that's such an important pathway into the middle class, we got to make sure that pathway is available on an equitable basis. That means including more women. That means including more workers. No one should have the experience in, for example, a neighborhood that's mainly a community of color, of walking or driving to work, noticing they go past a work site and feeling that the workers on that work site don't resemble the neighborhood or the community where the investment is happening. And with all of the dollars that are about to flow through our system, if we pass this jobs plan, we've got to work to make sure that the workers on the sites and the ownership of the businesses that are doing the work reflects this country, reflects the taxpayers who are paying for this in the first place. It's one of the reasons why we're serious about equity in every dimension of this. The idea of Justice 40, that 40% of the investments in things like climate improvement go to communities that have been underserved, overburdened, or excluded in the past. And we got to find all kinds of tools to do this, from pre-apprenticeship programs to creative use of project labor agreements, to make sure that we're maximizing that access, because that's how we build a robust, enduring ladder of economic opportunity.
Mr. Secretary, thank you for not only engaging that answer around workforce, but also equity. And so the next question is around connectivity in rural areas across our country. And this question is from Mike Woods in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Mr. Secretary, the question is, how will rural America fare as the administration moves forward with your infrastructure plan?
Thanks for the great question. I once experienced something called Bad Brad's Barbecue in Stillwater, Oklahoma, and I'll never forget it. And it's communities like those that are in our less dense, more spread out area that we have in mind when we talk about making sure every region benefits from this. It's why there's an emphasis on broadband. Far too many Americans right now still don't have an affordable way or any way at all to get high-speed internet access. But the truth is you need that for everything from doing your homework to being able to participate in today's economy. We know that many of the roads and bridges that we talk about being in disrepair are in rural America. And one thing I think is especially important to point out about our determination to win the future with electric vehicles, to make sure those are made in America and that Americans are benefiting from it. I think a lot of people visualize EVs as a big city sort of thing, and it can be. But the more spread out your area is, the more driving you do. And the more driving you do, the more you spend on gas. And the more you spend on gas, the more you're going to save if you're not having to buy gas because you have a quality electric vehicle. And especially as you see these pickup trucks and some of the things that are being created both by new companies and by Detroit coming out onto the market in the next year, the more we believe that it may well be in rural America that people experience some of the greatest gains from our transition into a new way of getting around. So for all of these reasons and more, we're going to be paying particular attention, just as racial equity is so important in our work. Making sure we are regionally equitable, also very important, and one of the reasons I'm so proud of the president's package.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Our next question is from Joseph Malley in Westfield, New Jersey. And it's on the topic of financing. And Mr. Secretary, the question is, he says he's interested in understanding how you will attract private capital to complement the public spending for these programs, and to what extent will the program be structured to fulfill sustainable finance criteria for possible investors?
It's a great question, and we see a lot of opportunity right now. Look, there's a lot of capital. Some of it's sitting on the sidelines, looking for a good place to go where there can be a return with investors who are interested in infrastructure opportunities. Oddly, the U.S. has fallen a little bit behind some of our transatlantic partners in terms of mobilizing that kind of private capital for purposes that are consistent with our public policy goals. We do have some capacities now, including in the Department of Transportation, capacity for what's called PABs or private activity bonds, although we're already hitting the cap of our congressionally authorized room to work in that way to get some of that private capital into the system. So we're interested in more opportunities. What we're really trying to do here is not take the place of private investment, but stand alongside it. Sometimes that does mean making sure we're doing that market-making work in an area like EVs, where we need to kickstart it. Just like the New Deal kickstarted the U.S. aviation sector in the private sector by making a series of public investments in airports that might not have gotten built otherwise, and had they not been built, we wouldn't have had the kind of network that made it possible for the U.S. aviation sector to become the most flourishing in the world. So we're thinking about this as a both and. We know that there's no substitute for a public sector commitment to use public funds in the right way. We also know that it would be a mistake to leave on the sidelines those private dollars that could be helping to finance any number of projects in places across the country.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I'm going to bunch these next two questions because they are both centered around business involvement. The first is from Latricia Lomax, CEO of HMO Technology in Oxon Hill, Maryland. And the question is, how are you planning to incorporate small business owners for opportunities in infrastructure? And the other is from Diane Dossett, the founder of Chambers for Innovation and Clean Energy in Oakland, California. And could you talk about the outreach to the business community on the American Jobs Plan, whether it's support or resistance that you're getting?
Thanks. And both of those questions really go hand in hand. Business outreach is incredibly important to us, especially at a moment like this, because we're trying to communicate that this is an investment in U.S. competitiveness. The theme of the plan is infrastructure, but the point of the plan and the name of the plan is jobs. It's job creation and making sure that we are the most competitive country in the world, something you just plain can't do if you underinvest for a long time in infrastructure the way we've done for too long in the U.S. So we want to make sure we're in close touch with businesses to make sure we're understanding your stories and to make sure that we're communicating with you about what it might mean if you had access to more efficient or affordable ways to move goods and services around, what it might mean to a small business in a rural area if the whole region were better networked with broadband, what it might mean to a small business in the agriculture sector if there weren't as many backups around our ports, what it might mean to have the best airports in the world for a business that relies a lot on international relationships. We know that, or just playing a business with a big fleet, not having to pay as much maintenance because there aren't as many holes in the road. And we are finding a lot of welcome receptivity to what we're proposing to do. Now, we're also being very upfront about how we propose to pay for this, which is a rebalancing of tax rates, not to a high level. Most of our lifetimes, they've been 35 and up. We're proposing 28. And that's to make sure that it's fully paid for, but to do it at a level that keeps U.S. business incredibly competitive. Of course, part of what we're also trying to do with a lot of the corporate tax reforms that are contemplated here is reduce that distance, that daylight between the sticker tax rate and the effective tax rate. And this is, I think, especially important when it comes to leveling the playing field for small business, because when you read the stories about companies that make sometimes billions in profits and pay zero in taxes, we know that those aren't usually America's small businesses that we're talking about. So whenever we have businesses that are working hard to make that return, to keep people at work, to grow and create jobs, we want to support that on fair terms. And that's where a reasonable revenue structure and the kind of investment that's actually going to make everybody better off in a position to win go hand in hand. That's a case we got to keep making. The good news is the American people already agree with us, but we've got to keep making that case because one thing I've learned is just because the American people want something, even if it's true on both sides of the aisle, doesn't necessarily mean Washington's going to follow suit unless you really push.
I got you. Well, again, a big thank you to the power of our local business leaders for engaging their local leaders as well as the federal government, which leads me to my last quick question, Mr. Secretary, and it's from Tamara Brown, the Director of Government Affairs at Chagrin Associates in Chesterton, Indiana. And the question is, in the new American Jobs Plan, does the administration intend to fast track certain infrastructure projects that have been subject to delays for decades? And if so, how can the Buy American provisions provide a jumpstart to aid local manufacturers and workers?
Well, it's great to hear a question from Tamara in Chesterton, so close to where I call home. And yes, part of what we're talking about is projects that have been in the pipeline for years or for decades. We're talking about shovel-ready projects and shovel-worthy projects. So we're looking at things in the future still being developed, but there are a lot of things that have been waiting their turn for a long time. And there are a lot of things we can do to simplify processes. We're working hard in the department to be user-friendly for some of the permitting that goes on to make sure, without cutting corners, of course, but to make sure that we're easy to work with in getting these dollars efficiently and promptly out. But the number one reason why a project doesn't get done is that it lacks funding. Matter of fact, it was AECOM that did a study that demonstrated this a few years ago. And so we need to make sure that we're not allowing a lack of investment to be an obstacle for projects whose time has come. It's why we have funding for projects of regional and national significance that maybe are too complex or large to go through the programs that we already have, but also reinforcing the programs we already have with more dollars and the resources to get those dollars out efficiently. We know that if we get this right, if we get the public investments right, then private investment can and will follow. And it makes all the difference in the world to have those private players, to have businesses speaking up, sharing your stories, making clear your experiences, and helping to convey what these kinds of investments would mean for you.
Thank you, Secretary Buttigieg and Mayor Woodfin. Before we go, I have one last question for the Secretary. We've had many business leaders asking for ways to support the proposals you mentioned today. What do you recommend? And is there anything you'd like to share with our audience as well in your concluding remarks?
Well, the biggest thing is to understand the power of your own voice and the credibility that local leaders have, whether it's leaders in local government, and I've seen that firsthand visiting Birmingham and spending time with Mayor Woodfin, or whether it's leaders in the business community. You can speak in very direct and concrete terms, no pun intended, about what it actually means to fix roads and bridges, what it would do for your bottom line if we had better ports and airports, what it would actually look like if your employees could access their workplaces with better transit, or if your customers could better access broadband to be able to connect in with you. Sharing those stories is incredibly powerful. Look, the economists will say it, I will say it, about the economic growth we can achieve here, but it means so much more when you say it. And so I hope you don't underestimate, especially if you're a believer in what we're trying to do here. I hope you don't estimate the credibility that you carry and the power of your voice.
Thank you so much. That's all the time we have for today. So thank you again to Secretary Buttigieg, Mayor Woodfin, and everyone who joined today's briefing. We look forward to working with you again soon.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. For more information on Business Forward programming, visit businessfwd.org. The Business Forward podcast is a production of Business Forward, hosted by me, Jim Doyle, produced and engineered by Alexi Lippman and Alex Pastanen. Special thanks to Jana Platt. Thanks for listening. See you next time.